Good afternoon, everyone. So as you can see, worksheet says we're going to start on Song of Solomon. Now, we're going to look at one or two verses in Song of Solomon, but I think there's some things we need to chat about before we actually get into the text proper. You know, we usually just kind of jump right into the text. Psalms was different because I wanted to show you guys how the poetry functions if you've never really looked at that before. But we're going to approach this with a manner of caution before we jump into the text, and you'll see why as we go along here. But first question, and this shocks some people. What's the actual title of Song of Solomon? Song of Songs. Read the first verse. It says, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. So it's actually titled for us right there in the text. It is called the Song of Songs. Now, you remember what we saw that Solomon was known for? We know he wrote his Proverbs. What else did 1 Kings tell us that he wrote? Wrote some songs, didn't he? Most of those we don't have. We have this one. The Song of Songs. Think about it like this. There's other things that have been phrased that way in the Bible. The King of Kings. The Lord of Lords. It's a superlative. We would say the best. You know, when we add that to something. So essentially, the song itself claims that this is the best song of Solomon. Now there is some debate as to whether or not Solomon himself wrote this, because the Hebrew could actually be translated, which is for Solomon. So some have asked whether or not this was written about him and then given to him. Either way, we'll learn the same things from it, but it is something interesting to take note of. So it is called the Song of Songs. And sometimes in older Bibles, you'll actually see it called the Canticles. That's just a Latin word for the song, or the songs. I know some people get tripped up at, what is a canticle? Well, it's a Latin word, and it's pretty simple once you understand it. That's why sometimes it's nice to have a Bible that gives you a little bit of an introduction. It'll explain some of these things for you. So the Song of Songs, the best song, likely, I'm going to go with it was by Solomon. It seems, when you go through it, that it was definitely by him. So we have recorded for us, saved for us, his best one. Now, we're looking at this before Proverbs or Ecclesiastes for a couple of reasons. One, what did we end with? I mean, we ended with, there in 1 Kings, round about chapter 11, we saw Solomon passed from this life. But before that, what did it... What is the last bit about Solomon that we are told? What was God unpleased with? His marriages that drew him away into idols. And so we just ended by, in the narrative, we ended by looking at Solomon's marriages and the negative aspects of them. So one of the reasons we're looking at Song of Solomon before Proverbs or Ecclesiastes is because I want to help balance that. Because really the Song of Solomon is somewhat of a great equalizer, a great balancer to the negativity in those marriages, because Song of Solomon has nothing but positive things to learn about marriage. And if you go to chapter 6 and verse 8, it says there are 70 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. there's a very good possibility that this was written earlier in his kingship, because we know he had 1,000 wives. And yes, it says virgins without number, but specifying the 60 queens and the 80 concubines, I'm rather convinced that here we have a much smaller number than we're given of what he ended up with. And so this was probably written earlier in his kingship when he had, you know, a lot more wives than I'll ever have, but oh, compared to what he ended up with, he had a small amount. And so this was probably written earlier, and we're trying to approach Song of Solomon, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes in the most likely order that they were written. And so we look to this one first. So those are the two reasons. One, we just ended talking about Solomon's marriages, and two, it was likely written sometime earlier on in his kingship and throne, and his marriages there. Now, and this is something we'll discuss more as we're in the text, but this is something I feel needs to be pointed out before getting into it. There's two basic approaches to this book. In other words, two basic ways that people say what it means. One of them is that it is poetry, and the whole of Song of Solomon, by the way, is in poetic form. But the one approach is that, okay, the purpose of Song of Solomon is to show us the beauty of proper desire in marriage and the attitude towards one another in marriage. That's the one approach. The other popular approach is that it is an allegory that is not necessarily about an actual marriage, but is referring to God's relationship with his people Israel, and then later on, referring to Christ's relationship with the church. Those are the two popular views. I take the first one. Here's why. First of all, once you read through Song of Solomon, there is no inward evidence. There's nothing inside of Song of Solomon that would tell you that it means something else than what it says. And when we're looking at an allegory, oftentimes allegories will do that. Within the actual figure itself, it will lead you to understand that it's talking about something else in reality. For example, many of the parables of Jesus. And Jesus himself would let us know. The text would say, then he told a parable, so we know about it. Or sometimes when he told a parable, well, what's the meaning to that? And he would say, well, here's what this actually means. And parables use the allegorical form, and that means essentially an allegory is, okay, for example, in Song of Solomon, here's the husband, but it's not really talking about a husband, it's talking about God. Here's the wife, but it's not really talking about a wife, it's talking about God's people. And I can see why that approach is taken. And there's a couple other reasons I'm not convinced of it. There's also no external evidence. And what I mean by external, I mean outside of Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon is possibly referred to very vaguely once or twice in the New Testament, but most likely not at all. We never have God telling us, by the way, that was an allegory. For example, we have in Hosea. God says, okay, go take this wife, and this is a representation of thus and such. God tells us about that. Or, how about Sarah and Hagar? Now, those things actually happened, but Paul tells us this was an allegory. It did happen, but God is showing us that there's something deeper that we can actually obtain from it, something else. But nowhere in the Bible does God tell us that Song of Solomon means something different than what it actually says. A couple of other reasons as well. Now, we'll get into this more next week. There are three main speakers in Song of Solomon. And in the King James, it's not readily obvious because the translators didn't assist us by kind of breaking it down. But once you watch the pronouns and he, she, and we, and things like that, you find out that there is the husband speaking, there is the wife speaking, and then every once in a while, this chorus of women comes in, and the wife often refers to them as the daughters of Jerusalem. Now, here's why I bring that up here. Because if the husband is God, and the wife is Israel or the church, then who do the daughters of Jerusalem represent? That has to be answered. Because we have not only two actors in Song of Solomon, we have a multiplicity, but we have three groups, the husband, the wife, and this group of women that are specifically called the daughters of Jerusalem. Who could the daughters of Jerusalem represent? That's something that has to be answered. And some would say, well, that's not the biggest thing. Well, I would think that it is, because the wife refers to them, and they keep speaking up. So if we're looking at this dynamic between God and his people, or Christ and the church, they have to represent some group of people. And the only other group of people is either not God's people, not the Jews back then, or not the church. But I would have a hard time following that, since they're called the daughters of Jerusalem, to then say that they would refer to not God's people. And if you didn't necessarily follow that, once we get into the text, maybe that one will make a little more sense. Another reason I'm not so convinced on this is because very often, now, in very poetic imagery, and sometimes a little bit, Song of Solomon can be kind of graphic concerning the intimacy between a husband and a wife. And some of the things that are said, the husband for the wife or the wife for the husband, I personally have a pretty difficult time trying to wrap my head around how that could be processed as between God and his people or between Christ and the church. Now, there are times in the New Testament, of course, we know that, you know, the church is the bride of Christ. Absolutely. In the Old Testament, Jeremiah, God refers to his people as his bride. Absolutely, that happens. So make no mistake about that. But then the question we have to ask ourselves is, while that is the case, and Song of Solomon is talking about a husband and a bride, what is the link? Because that's what some have said. They've said, well, because the bride of Christ is the church, and so in a figure, Christ is the husband and the church is the wife, and Paul even talked about that, and he said, you know, here's the relationship, and we have that great image in Revelation and some other places. They said, because that's one of the figures applied to Christ and the church, we go to Song of Solomon, we find a husband and a wife, we've got to be talking about Christ and the church. But there's one thing missing from that conclusion, which is why you make the connection. In other words, if that's true, then what's stopping us from making every reference to a husband and a wife in the Old Testament refer to Christ and the church? You see what I mean? Am I making that point clear? I feel like I'm not, but y'all have to tell me. I'm getting some nods. And so, yes, absolutely. God is referred to the relationship that way in the Old Testament. Christ is referred to it that way in the New Testament. But just because it is doesn't mean every time we see a marriage in the Old Testament that therefore it can become an allegory or a figure for this. And if you disagree with me on that, just follow me over the next couple lessons. Kind of like I said with Revelation. I couldn't prove one of my points until like chapter 13 or so. So I said, just follow me and see what you think. Now, the other reason for this introduction really is the content of this book. Some are very uncomfortable with Song of Solomon. I personally know Christians that were completely unaware that something like Song of Solomon even existed in the Bible and were shocked to find it there. Some even tell their children that they're not allowed to read it until they're 18 or until they're married, which I'm going to show you today why that actually makes no sense. Some won't talk about it and some won't even recognize it. Megan grew up and her parents would not let her read, even when she was a teenager, she wasn't allowed to read Song of Solomon. Her parents would not talk about it. Well, hopefully we get there. I'm going to show you at the end of this that that's the opposite approach than we need to take with Song of Solomon. And there's a lot of good reasons. But I say that to say this, and then I'm going to answer question number 5. To say that I am... How can I word this? To say that I am not the slightest bit uncomfortable to teach this would be a lie. Now, why is that? Because this is a topic that when we approach it in this type of setting, we need to be careful about it. But it's also a topic that I'm convinced that we are allowed to approach in this type of setting. And I'm going to show you where that's happened in the past in the Old Testament. And that sometimes maybe we are just a little bit more bashful about things that we shouldn't be. That they have their time and their place, but we can't completely cast them off because maybe we're a little uncomfortable because of how we've been raised. So let me show you here from the Old Testament that it is okay for us to study this in a mixed audience. And like I said, I feel this is necessary to cover instead of just jumping in. Because if no one is familiar with this concept, I can see some of y'all maybe getting a little bit uneasy about it. All right. So first of all, something very interesting, though not commanded in the Bible, is that traditionally, many of the Jews, in public, read the Song of Solomon at Passover. I found that to be kind of interesting. Again, that's not commanded in the Bible, but that does show that many of the Jews back in the day were not necessarily, you know, casted off or anything like that. Then again, there was a sect of Jews that said you can read it until you're about 30 years old. So it went both ways. Obviously, you know which way I'm going to go with this, but turn to Deuteronomy 31. Deuteronomy chapter 31. And while this is not going to include Song of Solomon, what we're going to find out is that God says that at least Deuteronomy, if not the whole of the law, Genesis to Deuteronomy, had to be read every 7 years. Deuteronomy 31, beginning in verse 9, says, "And Moses wrote this law and delivered it unto the priests, the sons of Levi, which bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord and unto all the elders of Israel. And Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, in solemnity, of the year of release, in the feast of tabernacles, when all Israel is come to appear before the Lord thy God, in the place which he shall choose, thou shalt read this law before all Israel in their hearing. Gather the people together, men and women and children, and thy stranger that is within thy gates, that they may hear, and that they may learn and fear the Lord your God, and observe to do all the words of this law. And that their children, which have not known anything, may hear and learn to fear the Lord your God as long as ye live in the land whither ye go over Jordan to possess it." So first of all, we witness that God commanded every 7 years in public, men, women, and children, that the law, again, it's debated whether or not he's just talking about Deuteronomy, but I would say most likely he's talking about the whole law, Genesis through Deuteronomy, that they were to be read in the presence of all, and he even specifies so that children can hear and know to fear the Lord. Now, I'm going to show you a few other instances where this either happened, where they read the law in front of a mixed audience, men, women, and children. And then we're going to go back, and I'm going to read some things in the law that would make some people uncomfortable. But remember, God commanded that it be read in front of men, women, and children. So we also turn over to Joshua chapter 8. Because I want to show that this happened several times. Joshua chapter 8. After victory at Ai. Ai is the second city that they take when they come into the land. After victory at Ai, in Joshua 8, verse 34 and 35 says this. And afterward, he read all the words of the law, the blessings and the cursings, according to all that is written in the book of the law. And remember, Moses wrote Genesis through Deuteronomy as sort of one flowing narrative. So book of the law, that's what he's talking about. That's what they referred to that section as. He says, there was not a word of all that Moses commanded, which Joshua read not before all the congregation of Israel, with the women and little ones, and the strangers that were conversant among them. So Joshua, wanting to remind them, hey, let's remember why we have victory and who we serve, read the whole law to the people so that they remembered the blessings, they remembered the curses, they remembered why they were there, who they were there for, and who granted them the victory. Probably trying to keep the mistakes of the past from happening where they said, no, God can't. We can't take the land. Well, guess what? Joshua says, we're here now. We're taking it. Let's not fall into that trap because we're seeing these things. So he read all the law. Go to 2 Chronicles chapter 34. 2 Chronicles 34. Second Chronicles 34, we're looking at the reign of King Josiah. And it says in verse 14, and when they brought out the money that was brought into the house of the Lord, Hilkiah the priest found a book of the law of the Lord given by Moses. And Hilkiah answered and said to Shaphan the scribe, I have found the book of the law in the house of the Lord. And Hilkiah delivered the book to Shaphan. He found the book of the law. This was a pretty big thing to find the book of the law. If they found the book of the law, that means it was missing. That means for a time they didn't have the book of the law. And so Hilkiah recognizes this moment. And he says, well, we got to do something about this. So Shaphan carried the book to the king and brought the king word back again, saying, all that was committed to thy servants, they do it. So while they're doing something else, they discover the law. And we go over to verse 18. It says, then Shaphan the scribe told the king, saying, Hilkiah the priest hath given me a book. And Shaphan read it before the king. And it came to pass, when the king had heard the words of the law, that he rent his clothes. So the king tears his clothes. Why do you think he might have torn his clothing after hearing the law? Yeah. It was a sign of mourning. It was a sign of being really, really upset about something. And so it says, and the king commanded Hilkiah and Ahiakim, the son of Shaphan, and Abdon, the son of Micah, and Shaphan, the scribe, and Asaiah, a servant of the king, saying, go inquire of the Lord for me, and for them that are left in Israel and in Judah, concerning the words of the book that is found. For great is the wrath of the Lord that is poured out upon us, because our fathers have not kept the word of the Lord to do after all that is written in this book. So he compares what their fathers had been doing with what the law said, and he goes, hey, we've not been doing everything that God told us to do. That's the likelihood of why he rent his clothing. He was mourning over this, and he says, go and ask God about this, because obviously we need to fix it, but how is God going to respond? And we go to verse 29 and 30. It says, and the king went up into the house of the Lord, and all the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the priests and the Levites and all the people, great and small. And he read in their ears all the words of the book of the covenant that was found in the house of the Lord. And the king stood in his place and made a covenant before the Lord to walk after the Lord and to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all his heart and with all his soul, to perform the words of the covenant which are written in this book. So they find the book, realize they weren't doing everything they should do. They consult God about it, but then he takes the book before the people. He says, they have to hear this. They have to hear the words of the law, every last bit of it. Don't hold anything back from the people. Give them the whole law. And then last we turn to Nehemiah chapter 8. And in Nehemiah chapter 8, the people are in the midst of putting their anchor back down at Jerusalem. So many years have passed now between this and the instance with Josiah. Between that time, God allowed both kingdoms to be taken away into captivity, but he promised it would only last for a certain amount of time, and now they're coming back. And whilst all of these things are occurring, we go to verse 1 in chapter 8, and it says, "And all the people gathered themselves together as one man into the street that was before the water gate. And they spake unto Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had commanded to Israel." So the people come forward, all the people, and they request that Ezra goes and gets the law and brings it to them. "And Ezra the priest brought the law before the congregation, both of men and women, and all that could hear with understanding, upon the first day of the seventh month. And he read therein before the street that was before the water gate from morning until midday, before the men and women, and those that could understand. And the ears of all the people were attentive unto the book of the law." So he goes ahead and he begins to read the law to the people because they have requested it. Now they're going to find something similar out that Josiah found out. Hey, we've not been doing everything that we should be doing. Go verse 7 and 8 says, we'll skip down. There's a nice list of names there. I see Azariah is in there, but it says, "And the Levites caused the people to understand the law, and the people stood in their place." So not only was the law being read to them when they had questions, it was being explained to them. It says, "So they read in the book of the law of God distinctly and gave the sense and caused them to understand the reading." It wasn't just, "Here, I've read it to you, take it for what you heard." It's, "Do you have any questions? We want to make sure that you grasp what you're hearing." Go over to verse 17 and 18. It says, "And all the congregation of them were come again out of captivity made booths and sat under the booths. For since the day of Joshua, the son of Nun, unto that day had not the children of Israel done so, and there was very great gladness." See, they found out they had not been keeping this feast. And as soon as they heard about it, they said, "We've got to fix this." And it was the time of the feast. And so immediately they do everything they can to do what God was telling them to do. It says, "Also day by day, from the first day unto the last day, he read in the book of the law of God. And they kept the feast 7 days, and on the eighth day was a solemn assembly according unto the manner." Basically, on the eighth day was a solemn assembly according unto how God had commanded it. So we have here four examples of the law being read before all of the people. One of the examples specifically before men, women, and children. We have that listed there. So the children understand. That's what it says in Deuteronomy. And in Ezra, they're actually not just reading it, but they're explaining the law to them. Now, what's the point? Because someone says, wait a minute. When they read the law, that didn't include Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon's not between anywhere in Genesis through Deuteronomy. No, it's not. But the kind of content that's in Song of Solomon is in the law. We go back to Deuteronomy, or actually go back to Leviticus. And I'm going to simply read some of these things to you. Some of them we're familiar with. Some of them we don't talk about too often, very often. Some of them, because of the way the King James translators kind of phrased things, it was some of these topics the King James translators had a propensity to somewhat dance around what was being talked about. If you read more modern translations, you will see words and terms that you will be amazed, and that God used those words, but he did. And so for us and for our purpose here, it's actually kind of useful for me to be reading from the King James, because I don't want to embarrass anyone. And most of these you'll follow and you'll see what's being said, but some of them I may have to kind of give you a little nudge so you understand what's actually being talked about. So we go to Leviticus 18, and we're pretty familiar with this section. In the beginning of Leviticus 18, God says, don't do all the things that those in Egypt and those in Canaan were doing. Don't partake of these evil things. Don't do these things, but follow my ordinances. And in verse 6 through 9, it says, none of you shall approach to any that is near kin to him to uncover their nakedness. I am the Lord. This is more than just a visual thing here.
Yes, it is.
He says, the nakedness of thy father or the nakedness of thy mother shalt thou not uncover. She is thy mother. Thou shalt not uncover her nakedness. The nakedness of thy father's wife shalt thou not uncover. It is thy father's nakedness. The nakedness of thy sister, the daughter of thy father, or the daughter of thy mother, whether she be born at home or born abroad, even their nakedness thou shalt not uncover. And he goes down this really big list, essentially saying, you have no right to have any form of physical intimacy with these individuals. That's what it means there, to uncover their nakedness. And then something we're pretty familiar with, verse 22 and 23, thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind, it is abomination. Neither shalt thou lie with any beast to defile thyself wherewith. Neither shall any woman stand before a beast to lie down thereto. It is confusion, or it's a perversion. So he says, okay, here's a list of people you have no business having that deep physical intimacy with. That includes those of the same gender, and then he even includes animals. Can you imagine some of the little kids sitting there that day? Mom! What's that mean? What's that talking about? And remember, Moses said, or God said to Moses, these things are to be read so that they can learn to fear me. This is as much part of the law as a lot of the stuff we're more familiar with. Now turn back a few chapters to Leviticus 15. And hopefully you have noticed, I am also attempting to curb my words and how I explain these things, because I don't want to embarrass anyone. And I'll do my best with some of these things. But like I said, go ahead and if you have access to, you know, a translation in the last 50 years, write these verses down and go read these verses there. And they're much more straight to the point, whereas the King James translators, I guess, sort of for propriety's sake, sometimes we're a little more vague than God actually was in the Hebrew there. So Leviticus 15:16 through 18 says, and if any man's seed of copulation go out from him, then he shall wash all his flesh in water and be unclean until even. And every garment and every skin whereon is the seed of copulation shall be washed with water and be unclean until the even. The woman also with whom man shall lie with seed of copulation, they shall both bathe themselves in water and be unclean until the even. Now, if you don't know what that means, just think about the context of the things that we're looking at here. It should be obvious to most of us what he's talking about. That's in the law. That was supposed to be read before the people. Why I'm comfortable reading it before you. It's when we get into the explanation that I get a little sheepish, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, if you're blushing a little, I am too. So, but he continues, and this one's a little more difficult to pick up in the King James. 19 through 24 says, "And if a woman have an issue, and her issue in her flesh be blood, she shall be put apart 7 days, and whosoever toucheth her shall be unclean until the even." What is he talking about? An issue of blood. He's talking about her cycle. Anywhere she goes, anywhere she sits, you can't go there, you can't sit there. And so they had a whole process for this. And this stuff is in the law. God talked about this stuff. Now go to Deuteronomy 22. Deuteronomy 22. Begin verse 14. We'll begin in verse 13, really. It says, "If any man take a wife, and go in unto her, and hate her, and give occasions of speech against her, and bring up an evil name upon her, and say, I took this woman, and when I came to her, I found her not a maid." So it says, if he dislikes his husband, his wife, and he's starting to claim things about her, he's starting to speak mean of her, essentially he's trying to wiggle his way out of this thing. "I found her not a maid. I didn't find her pure. She was not untouched by another man." That's the idea. And he says, "Then shall the father of the damsel and her mother take and bring forth the tokens of the damsel's virginity unto the elders of the cities in the gate. And the damsel's father shall say unto the elders, I gave my daughter unto this man to wife, and he hated her. And lo, he hath given occasion of speech against her, saying, I found not thy daughter a maid, and yet these are the tokens of my daughter's virginity. And they shall spread the cloth before the elders of the city, and the elders of the city shall take that man and chastise him." So in this scenario here, the husband's making this up.
Yeah.
And there is this cloth brought forth called the token. That's somehow proving that, as a matter of fact, she was. And I think most of us here are probably old enough and experienced enough to understand how that would work. But that's, you know, a lot of people don't know that's in the Bible. And they get uncomfortable when we start talking about these things. And yet God commanded, this is to be read before the people. Ezra and all the other fellows there, they read it and they explained it in a mixed audience. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be careful or cautious. But my point is this, that it's okay to have lessons about these things in this setting. Let me give you an example of the King James being very vague. Just go over to chapter 23 and verse 1. It says, "He that is wounded in the stones, or hath his privy member cut off, shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord." Think about it. A privy means private. That's a pretty graphic statement right there. And yet it is there in the law. As a matter of fact, talking about the Levites that could serve in the priesthood, it said if his stones were crushed, he couldn't do so. Well, within the context of where we're at, now you know what that means if you've ever wondered. Mm-hmm. And for sake of time, we won't turn there. But you remember Matthew 19? Even Jesus himself spoke of some things that would make some folks a bit uncomfortable. Talked about God made the two one flesh. And Paul defined that for us and told us he was talking about the sexual union when he said that. So Jesus even talked about that. And when the disciples said, well, this is really hard. I mean, who in the world can keep this, Jesus? He said, well, let me explain this to you. He said, there's some who have been eunuchs from birth. There are some who have been made eunuchs of men, and there are some who have made themselves eunuchs. Now, what's a eunuch? Well, to use the King James phraseology, someone who has their privy member cut off. So Jesus even referred to these things. He had to understand what is a eunuch to get the concept of what he was saying there. And I think of how very important the idea of circumcision is to understanding the Bible narrative. It was the covenant with God and Abram. And it was continued through Israel. And it was something that was paramount. And it's something that Paul uses constantly in the New Testament to draw parallels here and there. And someone says, well, what's circumcision? Well, you have to talk about it to explain it. If someone doesn't understand it and it's paramount to Scripture, it's okay in this kind of setting to explain this. And again, I feel it would be wisest for the person teaching to try and choose the best words possible sometimes, but sometimes we just can't. We just have to go for it. So please forgive me if maybe in Song of Solomon there's time where I just kind of have to go for it because there's no other way I can think to explain what's going on. But it's okay. So this is not with the intent of embarrassing anyone or making anyone uncomfy or anything like that. Now, question number 6. What benefit can come from studying Song of Solomon? And this will become much clearer next week as we finally actually get there into the text. But let me give you some ideas. First of all, kind of the obvious one that Bible teachers always like to hit up. Hey, God saw fit to record it for us, so obviously it's important to learn from. Absolutely. That's kind of a given, though, I think. It teaches us about a lot of things. We're going to learn about marriage. We're going to learn about the marriage bed. We're going to learn about the desire, the respect, and the appreciation that a husband and a wife should have for one another. And we're going to learn about the kind of focus that we should have on our mate. We're going to learn that physical urges and fulfilling those urges are not in and of themselves filthy.
That's true.
But there's something that God created. Mm-hmm. He built that into us, male and female. We function together that way. That's very much intended. And Song of Solomon is a beautiful, beautiful poem that shows us that as long as that type of interaction between a man and a woman is in an authorized relationship, that it is a beautiful thing that is supposed to be enjoyed. Something I find interesting, we're gonna learn something a lot of people need to learn, which is why take the easy route? Why go for a one-night stand when you can have something infinitely more fulfilling? We're gonna get an amazing picture of that in Song of Solomon. I guess I should say Song of Songs to be consistent with question number one. I'm so used to calling it Song of Solomon. I think sometimes we're so often very busy denouncing folks for their promiscuity that we fail to balance things out by discussing how very positive God views authorized intimacy. For example, the Catholic Church holds that the physical union between a man and a woman is for one reason, and one reason alone, and that's to have children. They have robbed the Bible. They have robbed our very humanity of something God built into us that is fully and wholly acceptable, but we have to understand how to temper it and where it belongs. You see, Song of Solomon, obviously it holds value for those who are already married. But let me submit to you that it also holds value for those who are not yet married. Because they can learn some great lessons about these things before they get involved in marriage. That's really important. a somewhat uneasy question, but a question that I know that some preachers, when they do their marriage counseling, ask, and I think it's a great question, is how important to the two of you is physical intimacy going to be? Because if one values it and is really looking forward to it, and the other one's like, I don't think it's going to be my cup of tea too much, that's something you need to talk about before marriage.
Yes, you do.
Have to get that worked out, because there are going to be some massive problems. It's said that money and sex are the two biggest reasons that marriages fail.
Probably true.
It is actually also holds value for those who can never marry again. For example, somebody who was put away for the cause of fornication. It actually does hold value for them. Why? Because they can take that and they can teach others about it. And they can, it can remind them, yes, I'm sure, very, if they've repented of that, the, you know, they're still not allowed to remarry, but if they've repented of their adultery, it's a difficult thing to be reminded, if they weren't taken back, hey, I don't have that outlet again. Now I have a thorn in the flesh that I kind of brought upon myself. But it's a book that can help them just to be reminded of where those things belong. And as a matter of fact, I'm convinced that even teenagers, especially teenagers, who are trying to come to grips with their new bodies and these new urges that they have, I can think of no better audience for Song of Solomon. Because it shows them where those things belong and how to temper them.
That's true.
Because when we understand that, yes, this type of union is to be enjoyed, it is built into us, and that's okay, it'll take us a long way. It really will, and I think it would help. I know it would help assist a lot of people. So, yes, we are going to approach this, and I am going to approach this as carefully as I possibly can. But let's not be bashful about the great message of Song of Solomon, because it's an awesome message. And it's a message that we need people who are not Christians to understand that we agree with. Because too many people really do think that everyone holds the doctrine of the Catholic Church concerning sex. So, these things have their place. And when we have God's authority for something, it's a good thing.
Yes, it is.
And it's not something to be ashamed of or anything like that. We can blush a little in certain contexts, and that's all right. But I hope as we go into this study, and it shouldn't last more than probably 3 class periods, but hopefully now you can understand why we're looking at this and why I'm confident to teach this in a mixed audience. And I felt that that was very was required before we just kind of jumped into it. And so we always end our lessons with an invitation. Because just as it is the case with intimacy and marriage, it has to be by the authority of God. Everything in our life, to please God, we have to do what we can to live by His authority. And so if we want to live by the authority of God and we want to have that home in heaven, we have to follow Jesus. And Jesus says, I am the shepherd, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. Come to me. Come to me and follow me. The truth will set you free. But only once you followed Him.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we always end this with a reminder to those who are following Jesus, who have begun to do so, that we're always here for one another if we can help each other. And if you haven't begun to do that, to follow Jesus, we're also here to help you with that as well. If we can help you in any way, please let us know as we stand and sing.